It's Friday, March 26th. Was it worth the wait? We start here. 2 months into the job, President Biden gives his first real press conference.
Is what's happening inside acceptable to you? And when is this going to be fixed?
That's a serious question, right?
Our Cecilia Vega had perhaps the most revealing back and forth with him. We'll walk you through the moments that matter. If you employ a man accused of serial sexual abuse, it could cost you $1 billion.
What they're saying is, why did you let this happen?
Why a blockbuster settlement from USC just signaled a new milestone for Me Too. And yes, you probably should get vaccinated against COVID, but can anyone make you?
You have a religious objection. I guess that means you can't live in the dorm.
From schools to airlines to your own boss, who's immune legally? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There are lots of differences between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, but one of the most fundamental differences is how they think about getting the nation's attention.
Well, we had very successful briefings. I was doing them, and we had a lot of people watching, record numbers watching.
President Trump thrived on dominating Americans' attention spans, right? All day, every day, he was determined to be in the middle of the public debate. President Biden has clearly decided that's not how he wants to govern.
The president takes questions several times a week. He took questions actually twice yesterday.
You're more likely to get information from his press secretary, from his cabinet, or just from the paper, from the actions he has signed. He figures that's what you really want to know anyway. But that attitude has also led to a frustration from some Americans, especially reporters, but really anyone who wants to know what we got from President Trump so frequently. Where do you stand? What do you believe in your heart of hearts? What are you thinking? And for the first 65 days of his presidency, President Biden went without giving a formal press conference to explain himself.
Please, please, down. Thank you. Thank you.
That streak came to an end yesterday as he walked into the East Room. Right there was ABC's chief White House correspondent Cecilia Vega. She was there asking questions. She leads us off this morning. Cecilia, I want to talk about specific issues, but first, just generally, was there a takeaway as to how he's doing this job, how he's feeling about this job? What is at the top of his mind?
Well, I think, Brad, the big takeaway right now is that this was a long time coming. 65 days into the administration, he finally does this press conference. There were a lot of expectations. There were a lot of eyeballs.
I'm going to say something outrageous. I have never been particularly poor at calculating how to get things done in the United States Senate. So the best way to get something done, if you...
And the president actually seemed like he had a lot he wanted to get off his chest. His answers were long.
Anyway, we're going to get a lot done. And if we have to, if there's complete lockdown and chaos as a consequence of the filibuster, then we'll have to go beyond what I'm talking about.
They were long-winded at times. At times, they were a little bit all over the map.
You also just made some news by saying that you are going to run for re-election.
That is my expectation.
So is that a yes, that you are running for re-election?
Look, I don't know where you guys come from, man. I've never been able to travel. I'm a great respecter of fate. I've never been able to plan 3.5 years ahead for certain.
He didn't bristle, I should say, at any of the topics per se, but there were some testy exchanges when it came to some of the questions on immigration.
Right. I was going to say the topic of the day seemed to be immigration. And really, the images he seems most bothered by are the ones of children piling up at facilities near the border as they come into this country. And your reporting at the border seemed to genuinely affect him.
Cecilia Vega.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about striking a nerve. You know, I asked him point blank. There's this facility in Donna, Texas, where I've been.
1,556% capacity.
Yep.
Right now with mostly unaccompanied minors. There are kids that are sleeping on floors. They are packed into these pods.
We hadn't heard until now what the president thought of those images. And you know, he's a very tactile politician. He's an emotional guy. So I wanted to hear from him. Is this acceptable to you?
Is what's happening inside acceptable to you? And when is this going to be fixed?
That's a serious question, right? Is it acceptable to me? Come on. That's why we're going to be moving 1,000 of those kids out quickly.
He says, of course, it's absolutely unacceptable. But, Brad, the reality is it's happening right now on his watch. And the lawyers that I've talked to who are talking to those kids in there are deeply concerned by what they're seeing. We are talking about severe overcrowding.
And that's I'm still trying to get a sense of, like, does he see this as his problem that he could have done more to avoid? Because he wasn't even really willing to admit that the numbers are different from under President Trump.
He sees this as a problem that is bigger than almost everybody. He is looking at the root causes of migration, which a lot of immigration advocates and people who are very concerned about the fate of these children say that is the solution to this.
And I started to deal with it back when I was a United States senator, vice president, for putting together a bipartisan plan of over $700 million to do with the root causes of why people are leaving. What did Trump do? He eliminated that funding. He didn't use it. He didn't do it.
But fixing that is not going to fix the problem that's happening right now, this urgent emergency that's happening at the border. That's a long time away. What the president is doing is blaming former President Trump.
Sir, I just got back last night from a reporting trip to the border where I met 9-year-old Josel, who walked here from Honduras by himself, along with another little boy. He had that phone number on him. And we were able to call his family. His mother says that she sent her son to this country because she believes that you are not deporting unaccompanied minors like her son. That's why she sent him alone from Honduras.
And I pushed him on that. I said, at some point, though, is this your responsibility?
Well, look. The idea that I'm going to say, which I would never do, if an unaccompanied child ends up at the border, we're just going to let him starve to death and stay on the other side. No previous administration did that either, except Trump.
And he basically said, I'm not going to apologize for that.
Rolling back the policies of remain in Mexico, sitting on the edge of the Rio Grande in a muddy circumstance with not enough to eat. I make no apologies for that. I make no apologies for ending programs that did not exist before Trump became president.
At one point, I think he was talking about guns. He basically said the best presidents have to pick their spots, right? Like they plot out the best order of events where they can get the most done. But we've also heard that he wants to go really big, really ambitious, like even make a bigger impact than Barack Obama. So I guess I'm just wondering what is next for him?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a reality check that we're seeing happen here. He's now more than 2 months on the job. He passed COVID relief. He did that without any Republican support. And there's a bit of an awakening happening in the West Wing of the White House that this perhaps is easier said than done.
Have you had any talks with Senate Republicans who are threatening this administration with not considering the immigration legislation that was passed in the House until the situation at the border has been resolved?
No, because I know they have to posture for a while. They sort of got to get out of their system.
If they couldn't get Republican support for something as popular as COVID relief and those $1,400 stimulus checks, how are they going to possibly get it on immigration? How are they going to possibly get it on something as controversial and heavy as gun reform?
Wondering if you've made a decision either about sending the manufacturer liability bill that you had promised on day one to Capitol Hill, or executive actions like going after ghost guns or giving money to cities and states to battle gun control?
All the above. It's a matter of timing.
And frankly, the president was asked, is gun reform your top priority?
The future rests on whether or not we have the best airports that can accommodate air travel.
And he kind of pivoted. Yeah. He said, well, infrastructure is really important. Right. So he's putting the ball in Republicans' court right now and saying, you guys have had to come to the table and come and help us too. But there is no indication from Republicans on Capitol Hill that you're going to see, you know, a big kumbaya between Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden anytime soon.
Right. If we saw him essentially daring Republicans to oppose him on that big spending package, we could see him do the exact same thing with like a $5 trillion infrastructure plan. Cecilia Vega, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, asking for donations is about to get tricky. Why USC just agreed to the biggest sexual abuse settlement in history after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much I know.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
When you take a look at the biggest out-of-court settlements in history, there are some huge numbers. In the late 90s, tobacco companies shelled out $200 billion for their role in smoking-related illnesses. The BP oil spill, $20 billion. Enron, $7 billion. Fen-Phen diet pills, $4 billion. But that's really the areas in which these monster settlements have always been. Massive environmental damages, big pharma, securities fraud, that kind of stuff. Well, yesterday in California, we saw a settlement over allegations of sexual abuse that begins to rival those numbers. Nearly $1 billion, the biggest settlement over sex abuse accusations in history.
An $852 million settlement for 710 women. If you add the settlements in that where lawyers took less, it's $1.1 billion.
It all revolves around accusations of a gynecologist who worked at the University of Southern California for 25 years, George Tyndall. And ABC producer Ashley Regal, who's based in Los Angeles, has been digging into these allegations for basically years now. I do want to warn listeners that this segment includes descriptions of sexual assault. And Ashley, first, just tell me about the settlement. How much money are we talking?
Hey, Brad. So what we're talking about is believed to be the largest settlement against a university in U.S. history. The settlement has totaled at over $1 billion. This is rooted in allegations of sexual abuse regarding University of Southern California's previous gynecologist, Dr. George Tyndall.
There are literally thousands of women that man assaulted in that health center. And worse, and I want this to be clear, USC and senior administrators at USC in the health center and otherwise knew.
Tyndall faces 35 criminal counts of alleged sexual misconduct from the year 2009 to 2016 at the university's health center. He's pleaded not guilty, and so thus far he's been found guilty of no crimes. But the allegations that have been made against him range from inappropriate touch, inappropriate commentary about women's bodies.
Behind the closed door of his office, he could do whatever he wanted to me, and USC would do nothing.
He tried to pretend that everything he was doing was normal and necessary.
And inappropriate taking up photos of women's genitalia during health examinations that are now believed to have been completely unnecessary.
When he took his camera out to take pictures of me and asked me to participate in those photos, well, what did I know? When he lied to me and told me I had a sexually transmitted disease, I trusted him.
And can you just help me understand, like, walk me through some of these allegations, because you've interviewed some of the women making them. And this, like, this was not just a doctor even, right? Like, he was the gynecologist for the whole university.
Yeah, I think what's really important to understand here is when you go to a university and you rely on their health center, you trust that who they're putting forward is someone who is trustworthy, kind, certainly a safe individual. And what it seems to be here is that the university did have indications for decades of inappropriate conduct, and nothing was conveyed to students.
In around June of 2016, USC put Dr. Tyndall on leave, paid leave, and thus began a lengthy investigation into all the misconduct claims against him.
The staff person I complained to on my way out the door looked me straight in the eyes and said, "Oh no, he's a good doctor."
The allegation is that he was allowed to continue practicing. He began there at the university in 1989, and he practiced until he was removed by the school finally in 2016. So nearly three decades.
This completely changed my life, what he had done to me, and how I live my life from that point on, how I raise my daughters, how I don't trust male doctors, and my daughters won't see them.
I think the reason so many women are so outraged, even yesterday, hearing them at the press conference, sure, this is a huge financial settlement, but it doesn't take away any of the pain. It doesn't take away feelings of mortification.
I was going to say, some of the women you talked, like some women, I believe, said this, like he was their first gynecologist they'd ever had. Like they were made to believe this is how it's supposed to go.
Certainly. I think people forget that, you know, a young student who's maybe 17, 18 going to college, she may have never met with a gynecologist before. And so there's an even greater level of vulnerability.
In the court filing, there's a description of a stash of photos of naked women, of women's genitalia that he had in his box. What was your reaction when you heard that?
Disgust. And wondering if I'm in there somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Women feeling extremely betrayed by the university, a prestigious university. Many of them had taken out loans, worked really hard to be able to go there. Some women had gone there for a master's degree. They were in their 30s when they visited Dr. Tindall. Another young woman we heard from was 18 years old.
I had never been to a gynecologist before. I didn't know what was or was not appropriate. And having a pelvic exam is not necessary to check for STDs, but he decided to give me one anyway. I screamed out in pain, at which point the chaperone said that she was uncomfortable and left the room.
She was gone. So she was uncomfortable, she left the room, but the examination continued.
Yes.
If you consider that he started there in 1989, and he wasn't forced out till 2016.
Like there's like almost generations of women.
I'm one of the first women to see him. I saw him in 1990. And none of these women here should have ever seen him after I saw Dr. Tindall.
And I think that's where you hear in the women speaking at the press conference the most pain.
Audrey speaks about being assaulted by George Tindall in 1990. I was born April of 1993.
Because what they're saying is, why did you let this happen? And even if it happened to me 20 years ago, how on earth could a woman who was there in the year 2012 be allowed to encounter the same behavior by the same man? Why did no one intervene? I actually got my master's in journalism at USC. I was there from 2012 to 2014. It's what led me to ABC News, so I'm very grateful. But I can say, as a member and alum of that community, it is completely devastated, the USC community of alums, particularly female alums. There's been so much discourse about, were you a patient? Do you know anyone who was a patient? Does anyone need resources and help? I mean, USC has brought in new leadership. They claim that they've made a lot of changes, not only to the health center, but with this giant payout and other changes that they've made on campus to try to protect students. But for so many women, it's too little too late. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of women who already saw him. You can't undo those experiences. You can't undo that pain.
Well, and so now then, with this dollar figure that we saw yesterday, the 800 plus 200 in the past, more than $1 billion, that goes beyond even some of these individual cases involving the Catholic Church. I mean, what does this moment say about the broader evolution of how we see sexual assault?
If the LA Times hadn't broken this story in 2018, the evidence seems to show USC was never going to acknowledge this. It was forced into the spotlight, so to speak.
The media gets a lot of criticism, some deserved, but here they served a critical purpose for the community, because if that story hadn't come out, he would still be doing it, or his secrets would still be there. He might actually be treating people in other hospitals.
And because of, I think, the Me Too movement, elevating women's stories, allowing victims to come forward and talk about situations of sexual assault, institutions aren't allowed to remain silent anymore. And when it comes to allegations of criminal conduct, that also means huge monetary settlements, such as the one we saw yesterday.
USC is not the only university that has a dirty doctor. UCLA has one. We know that there was one at Johns Hopkins. We know there was one at Michigan State, Larry Nassar. this needs to change. This is a phenomenon in medicine that needs to be exposed.
Yeah, almost that number when you talk about $1 billion, like that almost signals to the country, like these aren't just traumatic incidents, right? Like these are dollar figures that represent dramatic effects on people's lives, like lung cancer, like heart attacks. Like that is the realm that you're talking about with sexual abuse, and it's reflected in some of these dollar figures. All right, Ashley Riegel, thank you.
Thank you so much, Brad.
You heard President Biden say that vaccinations have taken a giant leap forward. And remember, once you sign a contract for 100 million doses, there is a lag time of weeks and months before they're actually delivered. So in April and May, there is a chance it could feel like it's just raining vaccines in this country. But there's not just the question of who wants to get a vaccine, who's able to get one. There are also people saying you have to get one.
Our students, of course, are mobile. There's a lot of interaction. That's what students do amongst themselves. They go back to their families, and we think that this is a way to keep them safe.
Yesterday, Rutgers University in New Jersey became the first major state university system to tell its students, if you are not vaccinated in the fall, you won't be allowed on campus. Let's bring in ABC's chief legal analyst, Dan Abrams. And Dan, I mean, can you mandate that a student get a vaccine? Because we see it in the elementary schools, I guess, for the mumps, but is that different with COVID?
The only thing that's different here is that currently, the COVID vaccine is approved by the FDA for emergency use authorization, right? So it's not fully FDA approved. If this was fully FDA approved, there, I don't think there'd be any question at all.
To even come to Rutgers, we have to have like a certain amount of vaccines on board before we even come here, before we even dorm here. So, you know, it's not surprising that Rutgers is, you know, asking for their students to get the COVID vaccine on board.
You always have to provide, by the way, outs for religious objections or medical issues. So remember that even when you're talking about mandating vaccines, you've always got to have the out for religious objections or medical reasons.
Oh, and so
as well,
that'll be the case on some of these college campuses then as
has
well.
Has to be. Mm. So, but I think that the trend, even with emergency use authorization, is that typically an employer, a university, an airline, a concert venue, et cetera, could eventually decide you want to come in, you've got to get the vaccine.
United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby said recently that the company is looking into requiring employees to take the vaccine, while noting other industries would need to buy in to make a requirement work.
And what I hope is that there are a coalition of like-minded companies that will do the same thing. And I think if that does happen, we'll just get the ball rolling.
Now, what's going to get interesting is, again, or for these exemptions, is so how are they going to deal with them, right? So So you're at a university, you have a religious objection. I guess that means you can't live in the dorm, right? You're going to have to live off campus. Are you going to be able to attend the classes? Probably not. They're going to have to work out accommodations for you. So
and even then they're saying, hey, it's the same. And as I think from students and parents around the country, we've heard, it's not the same. That's not the same experience.
Right. And by the way, keep in mind, there are some states now. Wisconsin, for example, recently just passed a bill which would prevent employers from necessarily being able to mandate vaccine.
Republicans say their bills are not anti-vaccine. Speaker Robin Voss announces he plans to get vaccinated himself.
But I certainly do not believe that as an elected official, I should have the right to say every single person in the state has to get the vaccine before it's been formally approved by the FDA, which it is not. It's been done under the emergency rule.
Remember that there are going to be state-by-state concerns when it comes to this sort of issue as well.
But, and so when we talk about employer, like if you're a student at a college, you're essentially like, I don't know, you're kind of like a customer, the way that like you can airlines can tell customers, hey, you got to be vaccinated. I imagine it's got to be a higher standard for like an employee. Can your boss really tell you must be vaccinated?
Well, I have to tell you, the reason that I have a little bit of pause about Rutgers is because it's a state university. Mm. So I have no pause as a legal matter in a state where there's, you know, no specific law on the books, where a private employer says, you want to work here, you've got to get a vaccine, with the understanding that there are always the exceptions for religious or medical reasons. It's a little trickier when you're talking about a government employer. Typically, everything has to be a little more buttoned up.
Now the controversial part. Faculty and staff are not required to be inoculated, only strongly urged to.
In terms of, for example, the FDA having full approval, et cetera. But I think that it's pretty clear at this point that, you know, that based on the CDC guidance, et cetera, as long as there are accommodations made for religious and medical objections, that even a state university can mandate that students have to get vaccinated.
Okay, wait, so the bottom line then, if I'm at a concert this summer and somebody shows up and they're saying vaccinated people only in this arena, and that person says, well, no, I got a religious, you know, I'm religious, I'm this particular religion. Like, does that work? Would they just go, oh, okay, we believe you, and they send them in?
No, I mean, probably what they would say is, okay, that's great. And we're going to be providing you with a live stream that you can watch said concert just outside the arena. So, you know, I'm laughing. It's obviously not a funny issue, but it's a real one that I think that they'll have to address. But there is no question that if you have a religious or medical issue, you may not get the, quote, same experience in certain areas, because many of these places will absolutely be legally permitted to mandate vaccines.
Really interesting. All right, Dan Abrams, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
And one last thing. If you thought that backup at the Suez Canal sounded bad yesterday, it's getting worse.
It's been 2 days and counting since everything went sideways for this skyscraper-sized ship, the Ever Given.
At this point, that ship wedged in the canal is holding up at least $9 billion worth of goods every day. And now officials are saying it might not take days, but weeks to remove.
Guys, forget Sasquatch. We are on the hunt for something that's very rarely seen on public transit. One might say we're hot on its tail.
And that might not have even been the most dramatic traffic jam of the day. Meet Rascal the Beaver.
You're at Royal York Station. You saw a beaver. Then what?
Well, I woke up pretty quickly from the usual sleep that I'm in. I'm used to seeing mice.
Yesterday in Toronto, a subway station had to be shut down as authorities found a beaver had wandered in. This is like the way cuter version of Pizza Rat. Just a beaver trying to make his morning commute. The transit authority named him Rascal. He called in animal control, and after determining he was fine, released him into his native marshlands nearby, where he came from.
Did the beaver pay tokens?
Did it ask for a transfer? These are burning questions.
That thing was huge, man.
Huge.
But this all played out much quicker than this gigantic ship in Egypt. At this point, they're talking about digging it out, but it's so heavy, you might have to remove all those shipping containers from the top, bring in pumps to take out massive amounts of water. Imagine what it would take to get all that machinery out to the middle of the desert, which is why, in the world of traffic jams, the word on everyone's lips this week has been, damn. Turns out the beaver also got another name yesterday. The animal control folks decided to call him Nickel, like as if he had tried to beat the subway fare or something. So Team Rascal, Team Nickel, you can let us know on Twitter at StartHereABC. Hey, if you've been jonesing for something in the Start Here feed over the weekend, I got good news. This weekend, we're going to have a couple episodes of the phenomenal podcast In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. Great look at the influence of a first lady. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Ariel Chester, Lewis Millman, Tara Gimble, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Joey Ibarra, Chris Berry, Brandon Bauer, Matt McGarry, Sasha Pesnick, Bonnie McLean, and Justin Gomez. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt
the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much up.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.